Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moscawain has the day off today. Remnants of Hurricane, now Tropical Storm Harvey, continue to pour down on portions of the Texas coast and Louisiana. Five parishes in Louisiana are under a federal disaster declaration, 18 counties in Texas. Parts of Houston are struggling literally to stay above water, and President Trump and his wife Melania are expected to touch down in the Corpus Christi area today. For many, Harvey brings to mind the disastrous Hurricane Katrina, which devastated New Orleans and other areas in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama in 2005. Former President George W. Bush took a lot of heat for what was perceived to be a slow and somewhat ineffective government response to that storm. So this hour, we begin by analyzing the response so far by the Trump administration to Harvey. And as always, if you'd like to call in, here's the number, 888-477-9499. You can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet to WHYY Radio Times. Joining us to get started is James Lee Witt, former director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency under Bill Clinton. James Lee, welcome to Radio Times.
Oh, thank you very much.
So let's begin by defining exactly what is expected of the president during times of natural disaster.
Well, it's really important that, particularly on catastrophic events like this, that the president goes to that event and shows the support, full support of the federal government and the resources that can be brought to the event. And also just to let people know that that the federal government will be there for the long haul in helping them rebuild and give them the confidence that, you know, that will help them. And maybe it will lessen some fears that the people have.
So as much as anything, the president's job is to present a strong and a hopeful and comforting presence then?
Absolutely.
So let's just take a quick minute to look back, you know, at the actions of former President George W. Bush, who, as just mentioned, caught a lot of flack for doing a flyover in the aftermath of Katrina. You know, in hindsight, there are an awful lot of resources being deployed. There's chaos in areas. You know, with all that was going on during that scene of devastation, did Mr. Bush do the wrong thing, in your opinion?
Well, of course, you know, it was very early and he was coming back from a trip and flew over the area. It would have been very difficult for him to fly in there at that time because it was right in the middle of the response. And, you know, when the president goes to an event like that, you know, it sucks a lot of resources away from the response. So, you know, the timing is important and where they go is important because you don't want to take away the resources that you're responding to try to save people's lives.
Yeah, President Trump is going again to the Corpus Christi area, and the storm is has left that area quite a bit ago.
Yes, and it's good that he's going down there because you know it does give people some relief and hope, and you know, and I hope that he'll get opportunity to visit with some victims and you know and reassure them that that he's there and the federal government's behind them.
On a practical level, the Trump administration has been issuing federal disaster declarations for many counties in Texas, now Louisiana. What exactly does this do in allocating resources?
Well, when the president signs the disaster declaration, I think it's 18 counties in Texas, and maybe some more will be added later, then it opens up the bank, actually, you know, for reimbursements to local, state, and local governments for the cost that they're out right now for the response. And then basically it opens it up later for public assistance as well as individual assistance. It, you know, it temporary housing can be, you know, for 18 months. And then there's the individual family grant program that if you can make your home habitable, you can get a grant to do that in lieu of temporary housing. And so there's several different, and then there's a mitigation program for the longer term rebuilding. And so, you know, this is going to take a while. It's not going to happen in months or year. It's going to happen over several years.
James Lee, thousands of people are now seeking refuge or have sought refuge in shelters. Mass shelters are opening or have opened in Houston and Dallas. If you could, give us a sense of what this operation is like for any one of these shelters. feeding people, clothing people, where they sleep, you know, keeping the bathrooms clean, tempers from flaring. How is this all organized?
Well, it's a massive effort, and you know, and it's organized by a lot of volunteers, particularly the Red Cross, Salvation Army, Baptist Man Group. There's a lot of NGOs that help and assist. And, you know, it's not just food and clothing. It's, you know, a lot of people come in there that need dialysis. A lot of people come in there with different medical problems that probably do not have their medicine with them and have been 3 or 4 days in a house they couldn't get out of. And so, you know, it takes a lot of work. And, you know, you couldn't do it without the volunteers, the Red Cross and Salvation Army.
Worth mentioning that there are teams from Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland on their way out to the hurricane tropical storm area. What mistakes have been made so far as Harvey unfolded? I know it's early days, but you know, I'd heard that Houston apparently did not order evacuations before this storm. Is that something that should have happened in your mind?
Well, you know, that's a call the mayor made, and you know, I watched him being interviewed, and I remember Rita, too, and when they started evacuating Houston and people got stranded on the highways and ran out of gas, and the highways were like a parking lot. I mean, when you go to evacuate up to 5 million people, that's a pretty daunting task. And I think about 100 people lost their lives just by being on the highways and stranded. And so, you know, I'm sure he looked at the lessons learned from that and trying to minimize the loss of life. And hopefully that's what he did.
Bottom line, in any of these situations, it's an extraordinarily difficult decision-making process.
It is. And you know, you make your best decision and you live with it and you move on. And, of course, after every disaster, you know, the FEMA and the state and the local governments will get together after response and start putting together a critique, a report of what lessons learned and what we can improve on and do better the next time.
James Lee Witt, President Trump has appointed Brock Long to lead FEMA. Tell us about him.
Brock Long is a former state director of Alabama. You know, he's a friend and he's got great experience. He dealt with 14 disasters in Alabama when he was state director. And I think Brock will bring some great leadership to FEMA. And, you know, when I was there, the 8 years I was there, I could never have asked any more out of the FEMA, career FEMA employees. They're very dedicated. They care deeply about people and what they do. And they want it to go well, and they want to make a difference in people's lives in events like this. They had a slogan and had T-shirts made, and the slogan was people helping people. And that's what they're about. And I think Brock will bring some great leadership to that organization and make it work well.
James Lee, you alluded to this a little bit earlier in the interview, but this story is far from complete. After the rain and the wind and the reporters and the cameras are all gone, what is next for municipalities and for residents picking up the pieces? What does help for them look like?
Well, you know, I know it's kind of chaotic right now, but, you know, the state and local governments, they need to start thinking now about how they're going to start the process of rebuilding. It's not too early to start that, because you can imagine thousands and thousands of homes and all the debris that's going to be coming out of those homes piled up on the sidewalks, and then also all the debris that's there besides that. And then you've got the problem of hazardous materials that will come out of homes and office buildings and others. That's going to have to be separate and disposed of separately than the debris. And it's a possibility, depending on how much wood type debris there is, that they'll use big grinders to grind that up into chips. And try to recycle that instead of burning it.
And also where you have flooding, you have clean water issues.
They're going to have huge infrastructure problems in sewer and water. And the other problem they're going to have is all of the streets where all these big trucks and stuff are going to be running over, the roadbed under those streets is going to be saturated and wet. And those streets are going to probably crumble under all the massive effort of removing the debris.
How much of the recovery, James Lee, depends on aid that is approved by Congress?
It depends on what cost share that the president allows. I would recommend to the governors and local governments that they try to get 100% on reimbursable cost for the response and then negotiate the cost share on the recovery. It could be 100%, it could be 90-10, 80-20, or 75-25. On a normal disaster, not a catastrophic one, it's usually a 75 federal, 25 state and local. And usually the state will pick up half of the 25 and the local will pay the other half.
Is there anything in this process post Superstorm Sandy, post Katrina, looking back in hindsight, that can be improved moving forward?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to start doing is, climate change is real. And, and these communities in Texas and Louisiana right now have an opportunity to make a difference as they rebuild. And, they need to really focus on building back better and safer. We can't continue this damage repair cycle in the way we have in the past. And mitigation and prevention is one way to help rebuild back better and safer. And I would just encourage them to look at that strongly and develop a recovery plan that's going to minimize that risk. For example, Tulsa, Oklahoma had a flood, and it flooded 1,000 homes. They put in a recovery plan where they, on a volunteer basis, bought out those homes. Then that property where the home sat, they built retention ponds. And during the dry weather, they had soccer fields in the bottom of those retention ponds. And then when the floods came, the retention ponds eliminated the flooding problem in Tulsa. Well, not to say that would eliminate the problem in Texas with 50 inches of rain, but that's just one thing that you can do and look at for your smaller floods, that might be helpful.
Well, this sort of process, of course, takes money. And we have a president, who pulled us out of the Paris Accord, and also a fair number of people on the Hill who are climate change deniers. So what needs to happen there?
Well, it's real. And you look at the tornadoes we had this year. There's a record amount of tornadoes we had this year. And you look at the just rainstorms, thunderstorms that we've had this year, where it would dump 6 to 10 inches of rain over 2 or 3 hours in just small areas. And, look at here in the South, you look at the month of August, we've had more rain the month of August this year than we've ever had.
So perhaps a turning point. We're unfortunately running a little bit short of time, James Lee Witt, but a turning point perhaps. All right, James Lee. Well, in terms of what we're seeing now, that perhaps this might convince some that climate change, according to the scientists, is real.
I certainly hope so. Because
I'm going to have to say goodbye, unfortunately. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off. The remnants of Hurricane Harvey are continuing to dump inches, even feet of rain on certain parts of Texas and Louisiana. And even before the storm hit, the U.S. senators from Texas, Ted Cruz and John Cornyn, were asking for a disaster relief declaration from President Trump. Two lawmakers who voted against an emergency relief package for New Jersey and New York following Superstorm Sandy back in 2012. Here is a clip of Governor Christie in 2013 during a press conference in which he shames Congress for refusing to pass a Hurricane Sandy disaster relief bill.
This is not a Republican or Democratic issue. National disasters happen in red states and blue states, in states with Democratic governors and Republican governors. We respond to innocent victims of natural disasters, not as Republicans or Democrats, but as Americans. Or at least we did until last night. Last night, politics was placed before our oaths to serve our citizens. For me, it was disappointing and disgusting to watch.
And that was Chris Christie back in 2013. Now, here's Texas Senator Ted Cruz yesterday defending his vote against the Sandy package, even as he asks now for aid for Texas.
The problem with that particular bill is it became a $50 billion bill that was filled with unrelated pork. Two-thirds of that bill had nothing to do with Sandy. And what I said then and still believe now is that it's not right for politicians to exploit a disaster and people are hurting to pay for their own political wish list. Disaster relief needs to be focused on the victims of disaster relief, and I supported that for Sandy, disaster relief there, and I would support that anywhere there's a major disaster without getting distracted by political unnecessary pork spending.
That's Texas Senator Ted Cruz speaking with CNN's Katie Tor on Monday. Let's bring Matt Arco of NJ Advanced Media into the conversation. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
Okay, so Ted Cruz won three Pinocchios from today's Washington Post for his claims about pork. What do you think?
Yeah, maybe it's four Pinocchios. I mean, look, what he said was just unequivocally inaccurate. It's not true. That money is easily trackable, so to make such a claim is kind of laughable. You play the career of Governor Christie, and I remember the rage back in 2013. I was at that press conference, and it's, you know, sort of the idea and the point that he was making there that this at some point won't affect folks that were ardent opponents of this. The writing was on the wall then that it would just be clear. And that's what Christie, when asked about it yesterday, you know, that was the point that he reiterated. And I might add that this isn't even the first time that Senator Cruz has asked for disaster relief. And I think it was 2015. There was some flooding in Texas, and he made a similar call then. But his claim that there was pork is just inaccurate. Really quick, I'll just pull on one thing that these opponents at the time have said, that, you know, hey, we're spending maybe an X amount of money for the roof of the Smithsonian. Well, look, the roof of the Smithsonian was damaged during Hurricane Sandy. So it's just not accurate statements.
So most of what I understand is that most of the claims of pork are actually related to disaster relief, maybe not necessarily Sandy, but, you know, forms of disaster relief from Sandy and other storms.
Right, absolutely. And like the National Weather Service and things like that, I think some money went to maybe one of their aircrafts to help better predict weather models and things like that. So, no, it was all disaster relief. And the two-thirds claim is just, you know, I don't know where he's getting it from. But I remember at the time some of the critics said, well, this isn't going for immediate relief to some Sandy victims. And that's correct. It didn't. Millions of dollars of the disaster relief went to rebuild, which took months, if not years.
So fast forward to Harvey. What are Senators Cruz and Cornyn asking for in their letter to President Trump?
Well, the letter to President Trump was kind of the prelude to what will come to disaster relief funding. And as of this morning, I don't think that a bill has been sponsored, so we don't know how much. But I know that estimates I've been reading this morning from published reports are estimating somewhere in the ballpark of $40 billion and up in damage from Hurricane Harvey. So we can expect those to come. And the president has said that he will get full support from the White House to sign any sort of disaster relief. Mike Pence, Vice President Mike Pence, has been in support of disaster relief despite, in 2012 with Sandy calling for offsets. There's no discussion of offsets now. So, look, it's a reversal and with some of these lawmakers, and it's, to reiterate the point that Governor Christie made yesterday, the writing, it was on the wall in 2012 that at some point, this is going to affect other states, especially if you're a state that's right along the Gulf.
Yeah, remind us, Matt, with the aid package, I believe it was a $60 billion aid package for New York and New Jersey. How did that aid eventually shake out?
Well, so one of the $10 million was in immediate aid. $10 billion was in immediate aid for flood aid. And then, you know, the rest was immediate aid, but then also, grants and whatnot for the redevelopment Governor Christie has been touting in the years following Superstorm Sandy. That money didn't disappear. It didn't go to build a bridge in California. The money stayed in New York, New Jersey for the most part, and Connecticut, and was rebuilding along the coast shores and parts of the inland.
So, Matt, you quote Governor Christie as saying, you know, at the time, this is, I guess, back in 2013, 31 days for Andrew victims, 17 days for victims of Gustav and Ike, 10 days for victims of Katrina. For the victims of Sandy in New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut, it's been 66 days, and the wait continues. To the best of your knowledge, was this a fairly accurate statement? And if so, why is the Northeast seemingly the poor cousin when it comes to disaster relief?
Look, it was accurate, and I remember that line like it was yesterday, because I remember the anger coming from the governor. It seemed genuine. I don't know if this is that folks hating on the Northeast as much as it's the polarization going on in Congress. At this time, there was talk of government shutdown, and Speaker Boehner at that point was contending with a lot in that moment. But you have these hardliners at that time on the right. I'm not trying to pick on the right, but that's what we were talking about in the moment, because they controlled the House. You had the hardliners on the right that were like Ted Cruz and the Texas contingent that all voted against the Sandy package that were blocking this measure. And I'll just point out that there was only one Texas Republican congressman who did vote in favor of it, and that is a gentleman who represents parts of Houston. So I guess he saw maybe what could come in the future. They all opposed it. And again, I think it's just the polarization of Washington more than the, hating on the Northeast liberal elites, I guess you could say.
That's somewhat comforting. Well, so
I guess.
I'm not sure exactly. Well, so Matt, one more question for you. Still today, even with all this, New Jersey is lending a hand this time around in Texas.
Absolutely. And Governor Christie said yesterday that they can expect more help. He deployed a task force Sunday night, and they just arrived, I think, shortly after midnight. And he didn't tell us what more can come, but he did say that there will be announcements forthcoming about additional aid that he's sending to the state of Texas.
All right. On that note, Matt Arko, thank you so much for joining us for a few moments on Radio Times.
Thanks, Mayor.
Matt reports for NJ Advance Media. We now turn to the nuts and bolts of what makes a monster storm like Harvey, Sandy, or Katrina. The National Weather Service tweeted this rather disturbing message early Sunday, quote, "This event is unprecedented and all impacts are unknown and beyond anything experienced," end quote. With words and phrases like unprecedented and beyond anything experienced, are we moving into an era with the potential for more superstorms, which can do extraordinary damage? And if so, how do we prepare for them? Tony Broccoli is here with us now. He is a professor at the School of Environmental and Biological Sciences at Rutgers University and co-director of the Rutgers Climate Institute. Welcome to Radio Times, Tony.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. So how would you characterize Harvey and the National Weather Service tweet? What was your reaction to both?
Well, certainly as a meteorologist, I could see the same things that the National Weather Service was seeing on Sunday morning, namely that this was, as most hurricanes are, a very moisture-laden storm, drawing a lot of energy from the warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico, also drawing a lot of moisture from the warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico, and that unfortunately for the residents of Texas, that this storm was going to slow down upon reaching the coast, meaning that there was potential for heavy rain to occur over an extended period of time, with the same places getting heavy rain over and over again.
In my listening to this story over the past number of days, I heard an analogy. It's almost as if Harvey has a toe in the Gulf of Mexico, and this is what is making this storm so dangerous. Keeping a
right.
toe in the Gulf of Mexico.
The position that the storm was in when it slowed down still managed to keep much of its circulation over the Gulf of Mexico. So as hurricanes typically do after they make landfall, the strong winds diminished. It's still windy. It's still tropical storm force winds occurring, especially out over the Gulf waters. But the moisture feed from the Gulf of Mexico continued. It continued to draw that warm, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico into the circulation. And because the storm wasn't moving, those heavy rain bands remained located over roughly the same area hour after hour and even day after day.
Aggravated by the fact that the Gulf of Mexico is actually a little bit warmer than it normally is.
Yes, temperatures there are a little bit warmer, and certainly because the amount of moisture that can exist in the atmosphere depends on temperature, when you make things a little bit warmer, that gives the atmosphere greater capacity for holding moisture.
We are speaking right now with Tony Broccoli, who's a professor at Rutgers University's Department of Environmental Sciences. And the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation is 888-477-9499. You can also send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And Tony, it struck me that so often in the coverage surrounding Harvey, when talking about rainfall, we're hearing the word feet used instead of inches. Is it somewhat out of the ordinary to use the words feet of rain when referencing events like hurricanes?
Well, it certainly is unusual. Hurricanes can produce prodigious amounts of rain. In fact, some of the storms that were the largest rain producers in coastal Texas were also tropical systems that produced feet of rain. I think what's unusual in this case is how many feet of rain have fallen. As of this morning, I've seen reports of between 40 and 45 inches of rain. So we're now approaching 3.5-4 feet of rain in some of the wettest areas in the metro Houston area.
I've got a question from a listener, and the question is, do people in Texas know that they live in an area prone to flooding? I'm sure many of them do, but do they realize the type of flooding that they are now prone to in that area? Is there a widespread recognition of the fact that we're seeing perhaps more ferocious storms?
Well, when I talk to people, and I can't say that I've had specific conversations about this with people from Texas, I think there is a sense that we've been seeing some extreme events that we're not accustomed to. But even without any changes in the kind of events that have happened in Texas and elsewhere, the Gulf Coast region is an area that is prone to very heavy rainfall events. I mentioned before the remnants of a tropical system named Allison about 15 years ago, producing very heavy rains in the Houston metropolitan area, not as heavy as what we've seen from Harvey, but certainly something that was measured in feet. So I think there is some recognition that these areas are prone to heavy rain and prone to flash flooding when these heavy rain events occur. But as with a lot of things, it all comes down to how much rain falls. And when you get a storm as wet as Harvey, then you're going to see flooding, the likes of which perhaps you haven't seen before.
Tony Broccoli, is there a clear link in your mind between climate change and bigger and or more frequent hurricanes?
Well, that's actually several questions in one, and it depends on exactly what characteristics we're talking about. The best evidence we have from our computer models that we use to project future climate change is that the number of storms is not projected to increase, but the storms that do occur have the potential to be more intense in terms of their strongest winds and also wetter. And in fact, the tendency for storms to pack more of a punch when it comes to rainfall is probably one of the strongest results that we've seen from these model simulations of future climate.
This tidbit is from Time magazine. Heidi Cullen, chief scientist at Climate Central, likens blaming climate change for extreme weather events to blaming a smoker's lung cancer on smoking habits. A doctor cannot definitively and scientifically say that one person smoking caused the lung cancer, but the idea that smoking causes lung cancer is widely accepted. What do you think, and are we starting to see more wide acceptance of the concept of the science to climate change?
Well, see, I think what Heidi is trying to get across there is that a lot depends on how you frame the question. If you frame the question, was Harvey a result of climate change? That is maybe not the best way to ask the question. A better way to ask the question is, does climate change alter the probability of getting a storm like Harvey? Does it alter the probability of getting unusually heavy rains? And I think for that question, the answer is yes. We do think that climate change is increasing the frequency of heavy rain events. This has been seen in observations from a number of different parts of the world. It doesn't just apply to the heavy rain from hurricanes or tropical systems. And we can say that. So what we're trying to distinguish is the idea that a specific event is caused by climate change from the idea that a specific event is influenced by climate change. These events are definitely influenced by climate change because it's producing an environment that's more conducive to heavy rains.
So, Tony, do you think then is it time to give serious consideration to the deconstructing of certain coastal areas, as perhaps houses empty, then putting something else in their place? And I know that one of our guests had talked about that a bit earlier in the program.
That's a complicated question because there's more to it than just the science of climate change. And I also think the answer to that question depends on the direction that we take in the future. Unlike some other facets of the environment that we have to deal with, climate change is something that is within the control of humanity. We can decide how much greenhouse gases we want to put into the atmosphere in the future. And the answer to that question will determine how much the climate changes and how severe the impacts on coastal areas will be.
Okay, Tony.
We're
up against a break. Let's pick up on that thought in just a moment or so here on Radio Times. We're talking to Tony Broccoli, co-director of the Rutgers Climate Institute, as we take a close look at Superstorm, Tropical Storm Harvey. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and Tony Broccoli, professor at Rutgers University's Department of Environmental Sciences, is along with us for the remainder of the hour as we take a look at hurricane, tropical storm. I'd call them Superstorm Harvey, Tony, going into the break. I'm not sure that's accurate at this point. But we were actually going into the break taking a second look at building in coastal areas, even deconstructing some parts of coastal areas as we take a look at warming temperatures and the effect that that has on water and flooding and et cetera. And I just wanted you to kind of finish what you were saying there.
Yeah, I guess in the short term, we know that sea level rise will continue and accelerate over the next several decades. And that result is something that will happen even if we try to sharply cut back carbon dioxide emissions, because there's a lot of heat that's already in the system, and it's going to take a while before the climate comes into equilibrium with that. So I think preparing for rising sea level is something that's very important. Those preparations can take different forms in different places, and there are different rates of sea level rise that are occurring in different parts of the world, in different coastal areas. In places where it's very rapid, then retreat may be something that is advised. In places where it's less rapid, there may be ways to adapt to sea level rise. But the big question is, what's going to happen when we get in the latter half of the 21st century and beyond, where the amount of sea level rise is going to depend on whether or not we continue to emit greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and continue to experience the warming that results from them.
Tony, are we at that tipping point yet, the point of which humans and other creatures will have to permanently accept a new normal?
Well, climate change is very difficult to reverse. So reversal of the warming that has already happened, barring some unavailable technology to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, will take time. It will take perhaps centuries. So in that sense, we've already committed ourselves to a warmer climate in the short run and out longer as well. The question of tipping points is a tricky one. We don't know exactly where those tipping points are. Areas of great concern involve the vast ice sheets that cover Greenland and Antarctica. The melting of those ice sheets, even the partial melting of those ice sheets, could have large impacts on sea level. And knowing how rapidly they can respond to a changing climate is essential for understanding how much sea level will rise in the future. And right now, this is an area of active research where we don't have simple answers.
Let's get back to Harvey for just a moment. We've got a question from Bill who asks, can you explain the volume of rainwater that fell? He says, I can't imagine several feet of rain falling. We use feet when we talk about snow during the winter, Tony, but rain?
Yeah, it's so unusual to think of rain in terms of feet. In the wintertime, when we get a foot of snow, of course, snow is fluffy, so a foot of snow often only contains maybe about an inch of rain. So we are really talking about vast amounts of water that have been concentrated in this area. And that's really the key. The way to think about a storm like Harvey is that it's collecting moisture from a large area, water evaporating, in this case, from the warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico, becoming part of the circulation of the storm. But then, even though that water has come from evaporation over a large area, the rain is falling over a relatively small area. The storm is concentrating all of that moisture in a relatively small area, in this case, an area that's probably only a small fraction, maybe less than 10% of the area from which the water was evaporated.
Is there anything you can liken this to? It's hard for me to even imagine, you know, I'm thinking dumping buckets, dumping a fire hose. I can't even imagine what to liken that to.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge amount of water. Falling, you know, I've seen some observations from the Houston area where there was 2 feet of rain in 24 hours. That's an incredible volume of water, and it's regardless of what kind of systems you have for stormwater management, when that amount of water falls, there are bound to be the kind of impacts that we've seen in Houston and in the surrounding areas.
All right, continuing with our questions, John asks, if every country followed the Paris Accord, would this reduce the effects of climate change? Tony, what's your take?
The Paris Accord was a beginning to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And the way I like to think about it is it's necessary to start somewhere. If I go to the doctor and the doctor tells me that I need to lose 30 pounds, the first part of that process is losing the first few pounds. And the Paris Accord is something similar. It was a starting point to try to begin the process of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. By itself, it's not sufficient to make the problem go away, but it's a start.
We've got a question, an email from Kyle who asks, are there any estimates about how many South Texas residents have flood insurance? I'm not sure if you have that at your fingertips, Tony, but we
do. I don't have that information at my fingertips. And of course, what will influence that is whether or not in many cases, if you have a mortgage, often the company that holds the mortgage, the bank or whomever, requires the purchase of flood insurance. And often that's determined by the designation of areas that are vulnerable to flooding. Mm. Unfortunately, in cases like this, there can often be flooding in places where flooding hasn't happened before. So that's a very interesting question, but I don't know the answer.
We do know. It's worth noting that the National Flood Insurance Program, which offers lower cost flood insurance to people in those areas, is billions of dollars in debt, having spent huge amounts following Katrina and Sandy. And this is without even accounting for Harvey. So we'll just have to keep a watch to see what happens here in the wake of Hurricane Harvey. So just on a side note, researchers have access to an amazing trove of weather data, which dates back over 100 years. Do you know where this data comes from, and how do researchers use this data for so long ago to try to predict current models, if they do indeed do that?
Well, most of the information on weather and climate that we have collected in the United States has been collected through what's now the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. And they collect weather information from thousands of locations across the country. Often the people taking these observations are volunteers who've agreed to have weather instruments put on their farm or their ranch or in their backyard. Sometimes there are also institutions. For example, at Rutgers, we have a weather station on our campus. We've been operating a weather station at Rutgers for over 100 years. The students go out every morning and measure temperature and rainfall for the past 24 hours, snowfall when it happens as well. And all of that information is collected and archived in the National Centers for Environmental Information based in Asheville, North Carolina. So that's where a lot of our information on weather and climate for the United States comes from, and other countries have similar arrangements.
Let's take a look at the Delaware Valley. I know Houston has been quoted as saying in the Atlantic, it's seen four 100-year flooding events since the spring of 2015. Houston, of course, is very different from the Delaware Valley and the Jersey Shore. Why are we not as susceptible to extreme summer storms, Sandy notwithstanding, summer storms and fall storms, Tony?
Well, first of all, when it comes to systems like Harvey, these tropical systems, we call them that because they are native to the tropics. They derive their energy from warm ocean waters. In fact, most of these storms develop over water temperatures that are in the 80s, which is higher than what we typically see along the New Jersey coast or the Delaware coast in the summer. Maybe once in a while it will get up close to 80 degrees. So tropical storms and hurricanes are less common as we get further away from the tropics and further away from warm water. Another factor that's involved is that for rainfall over the eastern half of the United States, the main source of moisture is the Gulf of Mexico. And the closer you are to the Gulf of Mexico, the more precipitation you can get. So that's going to make, as unlikely as 40 inches of rain is in Houston, it's going to make it much more unlikely when you get further away from the Gulf.
But yet, let's look at efforts right now to guard against a future Sandy. Some residents at the Jersey Shore will be quick to tell us that recovery from Sandy is still going on. It'll be 5 years in October. And the Army Corps of Engineers has since been building a dune system, as you know, along the entire coastline. Some shore towns and many along the shore are saying, you know, Sandy was a 100-year storm. Why are we doing this? It's not necessary. In your opinion, Tony Broccoli, can the Army Corps of Engineer project help to prevent the devastation of another Sandy? And how likely is that, that we'll see another storm like that within the next 10, 15, 20 years?
Well, the Sandy was definitely an unusual storm. We don't typically have storms take a track that brings them into the New Jersey coast from the southeast, the way Sandy approached. And that was more or less the worst possible scenario for causing a storm surge along the New Jersey coast, particularly to the north of where the center made landfall near Atlantic City. So for Monmouth counties and Ocean counties, this was one of the worst scenarios we could imagine. The only thing that would have made it worse would have been if the storm had been stronger. So in that sense, it's very unusual. However, something that's important to keep in mind with regard to storm surge is that sea level is rising. My colleagues at Rutgers have analyzed the areas that were flooded during Hurricane Sandy and have estimated that if the same storm had happened 100 years ago, there would have been tens of thousands of people that were flooded that wouldn't have been flooded because sea level was lower. And most of that rise in sea level in the past 100 years has been due to the warming of the earth, has been due to climate change. So when we look forward in time, with sea levels continuing to rise, it won't take a storm as strong as Sandy to produce the kind of flooding that Sandy produced.
So what
sea level rise is raising the baseline for coastal flooding.
So a protective dune system along any coastline, how protective is that?
Well, I think we saw during Sandy, particularly in some of the parts of the New Jersey shore that I'm familiar with, that places with dune systems fared better than places without them in terms of the damage that was produced to homes behind the dunes. Places where there were dunes, there was relatively little damage to structures behind the dunes. Places where there weren't, the ocean could rush in and produce more damage. But there was another element to the flooding from Sandy, and that's not just the action of waves on the ocean front. That was the rise of water in the Back Bay areas along Barnegat Bay, Manahawkin Bay, the Back Bays down near Atlantic City. And the rise of water in those areas would not be impeded by dunes.
So
there are limits to what dunes can do, but they can provide some protection right along the shoreline.
All right, let's squeeze in a call before the top of the hour. Gary in South Philadelphia, welcome to Radio Times.
Hey, I was just wondering, I heard you guys talking about the Paris Agreement, and you know, that I believe centers around less output of CO2. And I'm just wondering if we have reached the critical, you know, tipping point, and the climate is just going to go warm, does it matter that we pollute?
That's a question I'm sure a lot of people are asking. Thanks, Gary, for the call. You know what? What can the average person do, Tony? It's such a nebulous issue. I mean, what do we do? We stop driving our cars? Do we start to take mass transit? What do you do?
Well, I think one of the things that makes this issue very challenging is that it requires more than just the actions of individuals. It's really about an effort to produce energy without producing carbon dioxide. And that can take many forms. One of my colleagues once said that there's no silver bullet, but there's silver buckshot. There are a lot of different things. Certainly looking at how we use energy, energy conservation is one thing. Looking at the mileage that our cars get, taking mass transit, but it also involves things like changing the way we generate electricity so that we can produce electricity without emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. The other point I would make in response to the caller's question is how much carbon dioxide we put in the atmosphere does matter. It's not as if once we pass the tipping point that we can continue to put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and it won't make things worse. It will make things worse. The more carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere, the more the climate will change.
Mm. So to kind of wrap us up here, take a look into the crystal ball, if you will, Tony, for us. In 25 years, what do the seasons and the climate, what do you think it's going to look like in the Delaware Valley?
I think, broadly speaking, they're going to look similar to today, but everything is going to be a bit warmer. We won't see as many extreme cold spells in the winter. We'll see more heat waves in the summer. The number of days where the temperature gets above 90 degrees, and, you know, we generally use that as a threshold for a heat wave in this area, will become greater. We'll see more of those days. We will probably see more heavy rain events.
Less snow.
Less snow, but not necessarily that. I wouldn't look for snowfall changes as the most dramatic changes because, of course, if the climate is wetter, you can still get heavy snows when it's cold enough, but maybe the snow won't stay on the ground as long.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us. Tony Broccoli is professor and researcher at Rutgers University's Department of Environmental Sciences. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Our engineer today is Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nouri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and as always, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.